Hello and welcome to the Northern Agenda podcast, bringing you the big stories that matter to the North and from the North. I'm Rob Parsons, a political journalist based in Leeds, and I write a daily email newsletter called the Northern Agenda about Northern politics. This week on my podcast, I'll be hearing from two political best mates who were born just a few miles away from each other in Liverpool and have gone on to be two of the best known elected figures in our region. Andy Burnham, the Mayor of Greater Manchester, and Steve Rotherham, Mayor of the Liverpool City Region, have teamed up to write a new book where they share their formative experiences and set out what they say is an ambitious 10-point plan to rewire and reimagine our country beyond the Westminster bubble. Their book is called Head North, and it is out today. It sets out how both men were shaped in different ways by the Hillsborough disaster and how we can spread political and economic power throughout the UK away from the centre in London and towards the north. The timing for the book is actually pretty interesting. Both men are up for election in a few weeks, and there's a general election, we would imagine, not far away, where they might hope some of their radical ideas could become Labour policy. But it's also come out the day after one of the big set-piece events in the Westminster calendar, the budget, where Jeremy Hunt has been handing out gifts like a modern-day Willy Wonka in the form of a 2p national insurance cut for workers. Actually, the biggest news for the North, I think, is a big new so-called trailblazer devolution deal for the North East region, giving whoever is elected as mayor in May new powers and funding, and also effectively giving the green light to a massive, game-changing film studio project in Sunderland that could create thousands of jobs. But going back to this week's interview, I recorded it a few weeks ago with Joseph Timmon of the Manchester Evening News, and since then, as is often the way with politics, things have moved on a little. So you'll notice that we asked the mayors about Labour's plan to spend £28 billion a year on green jobs in places like the North, and whether Keir Starmer should stick to his guns amid reports he was about to scale the plan back. Since then, the reports have proven accurate, and Labour's green jobs vision is less ambitious than it was before. It's going to cost a lot less too. So you can judge for yourselves what our northern mayors might think of that based on what they said to us in this interview. So let's have a listen. So, Steve, your book is called, well, both of your book is called Head North, A Rallying Cry for a More Equal Britain. It's about your shared experiences in politics, both as MPs, but also mayors in the North. And it sets out, I think, a quite radical 10-point plan to rewire and reimagine our country beyond the Westminster bubble. So my first question to you is, why choose now to put this out into the world, and why write it together as two Northern Metro mayors?
Well, you'll have to ask Andy about the germane of how we've got to this stage, but basically Andy was enticed to do something, and he thought that it might be better as a double header because of those sort of moments where almost serendipity brought us in line with each other, and then you get the benefits, if you like, of two different voices explaining from different perspectives how we had to do things. You know, Andy in Whitehall and Westminster, and myself when I was a councillor trying to push things, and as the Lord Mayor of Liverpool, trying to push things on Hillsborough, for instance. And then how somehow we ended up working in the same place together, and then we were able to fight collectively for truth and justice.
Yeah, well, it is a fascinating story of how your paths sort of intertwined. And Andy, I see from the book that you and Steve were born 3 miles apart on the outskirts of Liverpool, but obviously these days you're very closely associated with each other. You're sort of described as political best mates, but actually, as Steve alludes to, you didn't meet each other, I think, for the first time until about 2008, and it was a bit of a sliding doors moment, wasn't it, in terms of how that came about, in terms of the background to it, but also what it led to and the things that you later became involved in. Can you just sort of take us through the chronology of that?
Yes, yeah, so I was born in Old Roane, so very close to Aintree Racecourse, probably only about 3 miles from where Steve grew up in Kirby. I was nearer to Liverpool city centre than the mayor of Liverpool, but we'll leave that to one side. But then when I was one, my dad got a job in Manchester. So this kind of, people will always think of me as more Liverpool growing up, but that isn't the truth, actually. You know, my kind of formative years were more in the end spent over in and around Manchester and the Lee area where I grew up. And actually, when you talk about sort of sliding doors, it was very much a case of different paths. And I think the book brings this out. Steve and I went on those kind of parallel paths that divide Britain. So I was on the university route and Steve was on, if you like, the technical route. And it's really incredible how that does divide people in our country. I write at some point in the book that the people sitting in their gardens in March 2020 were more likely to have been on the university route, those still out of work, not. These paths are very rigidly divided in terms of the lives that people lead. So mine took me through Cambridge University, initially the media, but then finally into politics and very much the connected world of London. Whereas for Steve, it was a very, very different path to politics and actually quite exceptional, to be honest, that he ended up there. But I think that's a reflection of the person that he is. So it's kind of an interesting story for that reason, because often these paths don't collide really in the way that they did with us. But when they finally did, at a series of events in 2008, when Liverpool was European Capital of Culture, when Steve was Lord Mayor and I was Culture Secretary, I didn't talk to him for the first sort of 3 months that we kind of kept bumping into each other, because I thought he was a Lib Dem. I was a bit more kind of tribal in those days. I kind of kept turning away from him when he kept trying to speak to me at events, and eventually he came up to me and said, "You do know I'm Labour, don't you?" And I said, "Are you?" And anyway, I started to talk to him after that. And eventually it was when Steve invited me to the 20th anniversary of the Hillsborough Memorial, and I was Culture Secretary at the time. That was really the moment that changed everything, as the book describes.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll come back to Hillsborough District in a moment. But am I right in thinking that the reason you became Culture Secretary is down to Peter Hain, who was the Work and Pension Secretary at the time? He got into a bit of trouble with his election expenses, and so he had to quit, and you had a quite rapid ascent to being Culture Secretary. So if that hadn't happened, you may never have met Steve, and the many things that you've sort of done together would never have happened.
It's exactly that. You know, we often talk about the planets aligning almost unbelievably at that moment in time, but they did. I came to the opening night of Liverpool Capital of Culture as Chief Secretary to the Treasury. And I describe in the book spending the whole night feeling envious of my friend James Pennell, who was the Culture Secretary, because I kept thinking, well, why can't I be the Culture Secretary when Liverpool's in the spotlight? But then unbelievably, 3 weeks later, it happened, because Peter had to resign. I felt really sorry for him, because it was quite a kind of technical thing that happened to him with regard to his election expenses. But what I do then describe is the randomness of Westminster, and that is the point here. It was a random turn of events that brought us together at that moment in time, that then led to things changing as a result of that. It was not through any design or anything that Westminster wanted to happen. The point I make in the book is that Westminster is neither structured nor programmed to deliver the social change that the country needs. And this is really the essence of the book. If anything, Westminster is the North's problem, not its solution. It was our experience from that point onwards, from 2009 onwards, that really convinced us that, you know, we had to do something quite radically different if we wanted to pursue the things we cared about. And that's actually why we wrote the book together, because when we decided to leave Westminster together, in many ways it was about forming a sort of political movement together. You know, this is more than about me or Steve alone. You know, this is about other people who've been building devolution over many years with us. And, you know, that's what this book is about. It's trying to sort of give a sort of an explanation and a analysis and a sort of set of beliefs, really, for a growing political movement in the UK, which is a movement that is cross-party for much more substantial change, rewiring of Westminster and substantial devolution of power out of it.
Yeah, and we're going to dig into some of those specific ideas a little later. But Steve, I wanted to ask you about the Hillsborough disaster, because obviously you both in the book talk very personally, or write very personally, about your experiences of that fateful day. It's where the book starts, and it's a running theme throughout. And why was it so important to you to open the book with your accounts of that day, which obviously cost the lives of so many Liverpool football fans?
I think it's because whilst on the 15th of April 1989, we'd never met each other, we were both at the two semi-finals in the FA Cup. One of them obviously at Hillsborough, and the other that Andy was in, where Everton were playing. And watching from very, very different perspectives what had unfolded. And obviously being there, I saw things that I wish I hadn't seen. And Andy was hearing the stories of all of those events. And when we eventually did start to get to know each other, Hillsborough for me was still one of those really great injustices that I felt personally that something still needed to happen. I felt very, very strongly that the government of the day, a Labour government, hadn't done everything that it could. And so Andy, as if you like, the physical embodiment of government, we were at an event together, and I said I was going to get him an invite to the 20th anniversary. So that's the thing that started with, you know, Andy being on the COP that day, being booed as a representative of the government, of the Prime Minister, speaking to Gordon Brown, he'll tell you all about this. And then it's the sequence of events that happened. And, you know, quite rightly, we say, you know, take any single one of those things out and it's a house of cards. It literally just collapses. None of those things would have happened. So we do think it is about the alignment of the planets. And Hillsborough was not only something that, for both of us, is a day that we will never, ever forget, it's also the thing that catalyzed our relationship and really drove forward what we wanted to do, which was to eventually get to truth. And, you know, after the 20-year campaign and more, we were sort of latecomers to that, if you like, and we did what we could do whilst the families and the survivors and, of course, the campaigners and the supporters had been battling on for years. But we did give it a little bit more impetus. And we're not trying to take credit for that. We're just saying that that's the reality. We did that. And then from that, a whole series of events led to the truth. The thing that we couldn't deliver on their behalf was justice, and still nobody's being held accountable for the unlawful killing of 97 people, and that's a stain on the British judicial system. And that's where then really we start to examine the whole structures of the UK and whether we can do things differently and whether every life is treated equally in this country. And we know the answer to that.
Andy, I wanted to ask you about sort of another big moment in the book. One of the extraordinary sort of revelations I thought when reading it was you mentioned that you found Steve was the first person who alerted you about the arena attack when he called, worried about his daughters who were there. And that was just before the chief constable called to confirm the devastating news. And you later describe getting to grips with the problems at Greater Manchester Police. And I suppose, you know, everything that came out of the reports that followed the arena attack as the biggest difficulty you faced in your first term. Would you say the arena attack was the moment the pin dropped about these problems at GMP? Or did you already have a sense of what was going on from your time as Greater Manchester, as an MP in Greater Manchester?
I certainly had a sense, Joe, from my time as an MP in Greater Manchester, 16 years, that GMP was an organisation that had the same defensiveness and the same problematic culture that other police forces had had. But having lived through what we'd lived through, Steve and I, sort of leading that campaign in Parliament and all of the kind of reform of the police that Theresa May, who worked with us as Home Secretary, was talking about as well, that everyone would have thought, well, okay, that's that, we can't, no one can be like that anymore. And, you know, Theresa commissioned a report on the experience of the Hillsborough family so that no one ever went through that again. What then happened was that, you know, I encountered some of that same culture. And, you know, that told me just how entrenched some of these problems are in the British state. A failure of public bodies to tell the truth at the first time of asking, to recognise wrongdoing and actually make amends for it. In fact, the culture's the opposite, and it's a pattern that I learned at that point really just keeps on repeating. And now we see this, the story around the post office, and the same again, where in fact, it's not about recognising things have been done wrong. It's actually that people then try and blame those who've been wronged and make the victims appear the perpetrators or the culprits. That's what happened at Hillsborough. It's happened with contaminated blood, where the people who were infected were somehow said, well, it was their behaviour that had led to their health problems. And obviously it's happened with the postmasters and mistresses. I mean, this is really the gets again to the heart of the book. The way Westminster is, it concentrates a huge amount of power in a very small number of hands. And the effect of that is it leads to a kind of huge accountability deficit in British government bodies and public services. It's very easy for them to create false narratives and to dig in behind them. And it's very hard for the ordinary person to overturn those narratives. And they have to go to extraordinary lengths to do that. And that pattern is clear now through the decades. And it's why Steve and I, you know, from our own experiences, mine as both MP and as mayor, you know, dealing with the people of Merseyside, but also of Greater Manchester, you know, it tells you that this country is not set up to work for ordinary people in all parts of the country. And as Steve said, it is the case that some people are seen as more equal than others. And until we change these things, you know, we're just not going to make this country work in the way that it should. And one of the big calls of the second half of the book is that Hillsborough law and its requirement for a duty of candour, a statutory duty of candour on all police and public servants to tell the truth at the first time of asking. If that had been in place, let's say 50 years ago, you know, the experience of the families in Derry who lost loved ones on Bloody Sunday, the experience of the Hillsborough families, the contaminated blood victims, the Grenfell families, and more recently the postmasters and postmistresses would have been fundamentally different than it has actually been.
So, Steve, the last few years when I've been covering politics in the North, I'd say it's really shone a spotlight on the power imbalance between the North of England and the corridors of power in London. I mean, you can think of examples like the way that lockdowns were imposed on the North at short notice during a pandemic, the whole farce of HS2 up North being cancelled during Conservative conference in Manchester. And the second half of your book, as you say, is devoted to your 10-point plan to rebalance the way our country's politics works. It's got ideas, as Andy has alluded to, like a Hillsborough law, the end of the whip system at Westminster, voting reforms, a Senate of the Nations and Regions. If you could pick just one of those things, I know you'd like all of them to come true, but if you could just click your fingers and one of those things were to become a reality, which do you think is sort of perhaps the most transformative?
I suppose it's the Hillsborough law. And just in case anyone thinks, oh, my God, they're harking on about Hillsborough again, this is not for the Hillsborough families. Unfortunately, all of the legal avenues for the families to get the justice that I've just spoken about have been exhausted. It's never going to happen. And so what the Hillsborough law is about, as Andy said, there's a duty of candor. There are a number of factors in this which will stop other people going through the same process that the Hillsborough families did. And that's why they're very supportive of it. They're getting nothing from this themselves, the families. This is about ensuring that, for instance, the hangover from what's happened now with Grenfell is tackled. We've seen the stuff on the post office debacle and scandal, how anybody could have watched that series, the drama from a few weeks ago, and not been emotionally moved by what was happening to those people. Well, it's not a one-off. And of course it's not a one-off. And we know that Hillsborough went through it. We know that, for instance, Orgreave, the miners went through it, et cetera, et cetera. There are so many injustices. So why wouldn't we expect that we could change things for the betterment of people in the future so that they don't have to go through the same things and we can learn the lessons of those great injustices? So that's the main one for me. But as you said, there are, you know, there's a 10-point plan and we don't want to pick one or two out of it, because actually it's a suite of things that can fundamentally address the flaws in the British system, including the judicial system. But also, it could be a framework, actually, for doing things differently and better for the future.
I think that, if I could, Rob, just to come in on that, because I think it's really important. I understand why you would ask the question, but it's really important not to pick one out and think that's enough. The Head North Plan, as we call it, it works as a package of measures, because it's about a rewiring of the country. And if you're going to rewire the UK, it can't be done by one silver bullet. You know, it's got to be a package of things that kind of change the way power works, the way it flows around the country. You know, this is a very complex, complete reset of the UK that's needed here. And, you know, that is about reforming Parliament, but also the way, more fundamentally, the way the country actually functions, the rules of the game, if you like, because you mentioned HS2. So I, you know, would come back to the starting point of a written constitution. Britain is only one of a very small number of countries in the world that doesn't have a written constitution. And, you know, in other places, this is often something that is needed to make sure that there's fairness across different regions and different people. And, you know, the constitution provides that protection for people. And the basic law that we talk about that Germany has in its constitution for equivalent living standards, you know, you've got to start there, I would say, and then all the other reforms flow from that. Because at the moment, you look at HS2, and Joe will remember this, that the massed ranks of the government come to Manchester for their party conference, despite pleas from the leader of the city council and myself just to talk to us before they take a monumental decision. They just sit there in a hotel and ignore us. You know, it shouldn't be possible, in my view, to do that. It shouldn't be allowed. It shouldn't be legal to do that. If you're making a decision that fundamental, that people have been working on for a decade or more, where it actually affects residents in the local authority area of Manchester, it shouldn't be the case that a government unilaterally can just ignore all of that opinion and make that decision in the way that they did. It shouldn't be legal to do that. But more broadly, the way national government treats local government shouldn't be legal. The role of each should be properly respected in a written constitution. Each should be properly funded to do the job that they are asked to do. Instead, national government places statutory obligations on local councils, but then doesn't fund them to deliver those obligations. I mean, that shouldn't be right. It shouldn't be possible in any normal functioning democracy. But that is the way Westminster rolls, and that's what's got to stop. It's going to have to accept rules and a way of working that is just normal in most other countries everywhere else in the world.
Andy, you spoke earlier about, I think you said, like a growing consensus and movement supporting the kind of ideas that you and Steve are putting forward. I wondered where the Labour Party's at on the, in terms of, you know, those proposals. So Labour leader Keir Starmer, he seems to be sort of making the right noises about devolution. Recently, he's spoken of winning the war against the hoarders in Westminster, giving power back and putting communities in control. But he's not proposed anything near as radical as what you two are suggesting in the book. What do you think he's going to make of you both coming out with these ideas, especially at sort of a politically sensitive time ahead of the general election?
Well, I think we're going with the grain of where Labour is going. But as always, it's our job to say, what would work, what would be the best solution for our area, for Greater Manchester and for the Liverpool City region. Not you know, just what sort of tactical solution, what would be represent the best. And actually for the Northwest, you can read the Southwest, the East Midlands, the North. What we're saying probably would be as equally true for anywhere. And we believe the Head North plan is what would be best. You need a fundamental change in what's needed. And we recognise in the book that you can't do that in one parliament. But certainly Keir and the Labour Party are now, in many ways, really talking to the same themes. I do personally believe, Joe, that this goes across all voters, all ages. I think there is a sense that things are broken. I think the pandemic has really brought that out. You know, this is a unique moment in our lives where everyone stopped and everybody watched the daily briefings. Everybody watched Westminster. Everybody watched how it worked and how it made decisions. And I think the pandemic is the moment, isn't it, where everyone went, God, they're doing things like this. So it's just a tiny number of people throwing out policies that affect millions of people, and they never really think it through. And they don't quite treat the North as fairly as they do treat London and the South East. I think people stopped and saw that really clearly. In normal times, it's a dysfunctional way of running the country. In pandemic times, it's a dangerous way to run the country. And I think that's what's being brought out now in the COVID inquiry. And it's why I think there is a strong sense now of support for, you know, fundamental change to the voting system, to Parliament, to the way the country functions, and baking in this levelling up, not as a sort of slogan that was thrown out in a casual way, but actually you hardwire the notion of levelling up through that basic law into a new British constitution. I think there is a political consensus around those things. Always leaders of any party will say there's only so much we can do. And we understand that. Steve and I understand that. But our job is to say, well, what would be the best thing we could achieve for our region? And that's what we've tried to set out in the Head North plan. If we want to close the North-South divide, if we want to have true equality in this country between all people and all places, half measures are not going to get you there. You have to do a very significant rewiring, and that's what we're proposing.
And I'm sure you'll be hoping this book will get a lot of traction in Westminster. Are you worried at all about how it's going to be perceived down there? I mean, obviously, there's been endless speculation over in the past about intentions to return to Parliament. Is there a risk that actually this could be interpreted as a manifesto for a future leadership campaign? Which, well, I'm sure you'll tell us.
I'm not going to stand. Just to let you know, just to put that on the record, I'll declare it here. It's next.
And I'm not running your campaign.
this How do you book think is going to
support my mayoral campaign,
because,
as you know, Joe, I'm standing to be mayor of Greater Manchester. Then the book was intended to support my mayoral campaign, and I know people in Westminster may view it differently. Steve and I have sort of discussed this. They will consider the removal of the whip to be naive, but I would put it back to them. You know, having been there and experienced what they have, but now looking at it from outside, if MPs had more obvious independence of thought, the ability to act more in a place-based way rather than just always in a party sort of harness, the status of MPs would rise. If you take big votes on big contentious issues, and I reference the Iraq vote in the book, you know, if that vote had been taken on without a party whip applied and people came to their decision freely, the decision would be respected more in the country and in the world, because people would say, well, okay, well, that's been made in the right way. I think the whip system kind of, it's out of time, I think. You know, people want authenticity. They want people to go in there and think and feel and, you know, bring everything about them to the decisions that they make. In our view, and this is right, Steve, isn't it? 19 times out of 20, maybe even 99 times out of 100, most people would back what their party wants if they broadly agree with it. But there may just be that one moment where they go, you know what, I think you need to think that one again. And if MPs had that ability and were seen to have that ability, their status would be, I think, improved with the country. So, you know, I've really thought this through carefully. I think the whip system hands power to unelected people. It hands power to the unelected state. Because MPs become a rubber stamp for what the government departments want, and they end up just sort of, you know, endorsing what the kind of entrenched government position is. And that gives you those long-standing injustices. That gives you a green book which keeps sort of pouring money into the London and the South East but never gets it right around the country. That's the problem. I think you've got to send MPs into the Palace of Westminster where everyone is empowered to act for their place. And you'd have a very different politics if you did remove the whip. And I would just say to our former colleagues in Westminster, open your minds to it. There's a great passage in the book where Steve talks about walking into the whip's office for the first time and said to them, I don't want promotion. So you don't even have to, you know, don't bother with me because you won't be able ever to persuade me about that. And I think you pick up the story, Steve, but you say that they were just so disarmed by that. They didn't even know how to speak. They just couldn't handle that, could they? But that gave you a power then that was good from your point of view, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And also, I mean, look, if this was Andy Byrne's book about Look North, then you could say that it was his attempt to try to look at the leadership. It's not. It's mine as well. And I've got no ambitions at all of ever going back into Westminster. And certainly, I've said it on record, if I was ever offered, say, there was something catastrophic that happened and I was the last one and he said to me, listen, would you run the Labour Party? Would you be its leader? I'd still turn it down. I wouldn't do a big clock. So it's not about Andy's ambitions. So let's get that one out, you know, and in the open. It's nothing to do with that. I'll tell you what it is. It's about our joint ambitions and a manifesto for the North, not for the South, not for ambitions in Westminster. It's about what we could do to level up this country, to make it further. And there's an old cliche, I know, that says that the postcode that you're born in determines the rest of your life. Well, it's true also as well as a cliche, because you have a look at the differentials in health outcomes. Have a look at the differentials in the amount of investment in transport. Have a look at the differentials in skills and educational outcomes, etc., etc. Well, are they a completely different breed of people, or are we the same country? And what we have here is not a lack of talent, but a lack of opportunity. And that's what we're fighting for. We just think that you could have a better functioning UK if areas of latent potential, because we've been held back, are given the opportunity to rise. And that's why the North, with 16 million people across the Northern Corridor, just think of twice as big as London. Just think of what the opportunity for this, you know, for the government, for UK PLC is to maximise the economic opportunities. You know, if nothing else, think about what that could do to living standards across the whole country, because we can become a northern powerhouse. And as we said, myself and Andy, if we weren't going to become a northern powerhouse, we'll become a northwest powerhouse and we'll do it ourselves. But we need the opportunity, and that's why we're constrained by some of the things that we want to change, hence the 10-point plan.
I'll ask you, I know we're running out of time, I'll ask you this one last question, Steve, and it relates to what you just said about, you know, the northwest becoming a powerhouse, particularly with regard to green energy. I read in your book that through a combination of offshore and onshore wind, solar, green hydrogen, tidal energy production, all of which is going on in the northwest, you could produce a staggering amount of energy, more than twice the total demand for the region, but it needs government investment to do it. So are you concerned by the fact that Labour nationally seems to be backsliding a bit on its flagship promise to invest £28 billion a year in green projects, which we know would make a massive difference? We're recording this in early February, and I think yesterday on the news, Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, refused to say whether she is standing by that plan. It's come under a lot of attacks from the Conservatives. Is that a concern for you?
There's lots of speculation, isn't there, about what eventually will come out. And I suppose we're going to, you're right, but in February, we're going to have to wait, aren't we, till we get closer to the general election before we actually see all of those different policy initiatives. But for me, this is, I think, is a real winner with the electorate. If we go out and say that there is an alternative, and that alternative is a green future, and not just that we want tidal power, but tidal power would create a huge volume of interest in this country in the way in which we use technology. It's old technology, but the way in which we'd use it for tidal, which means that we would get a skills boost, which means that we'd get more jobs, more highly paid and highly skilled jobs. There's a huge economic benefit of doing that, as well as, of course, the environmental considerations. But we can export this. This is not, let's just do something and then, you know, hopefully keep our fingers crossed that it's going to work. This is about, if we're at the vanguard of these things, we can create wealth for everybody in the UK. Plus, we'd have energy security and a whole host of different things. I'd turn it on its head and say, why wouldn't somebody support some of these great initiatives? And just to sort of highlight again what you did say, you talked about investment. It's an investment with a return. It's not a grant. We're not asking for handouts. You know, we believe, and we've got business cases that will show for every penny that we get, there will be a multiplier effect within the whole economy. And that's why I think we can win over the skeptics. But when the time comes, believe me, I'll be sitting down, Andy will be sitting down, all the other mayors will be sitting down and putting our cases forward. And ours collectively will be that we can become a net exporter of green energy in the Northwest. Well, why wouldn't we push that ahead?
So your message to Labour top brass is, for the sake of the North, stick to your guns on the 28 billion.
I'll be telling them to the face. I don't need an intermediary. Andy will tell you the way I operate. So I'll tell Keir or anybody else what my beliefs are. And my beliefs are quite clearly that there's a massive opportunity for the North here. Look, years ago, just where I am pointing sort of in the distance, because there's a place called Bebo Bank, which is just a couple of miles from where I am. And Dong Energy it was at the time. The Danish government invested in that. And it's now Ørsted. It's making an absolute fortune. Not a penny of it comes here to us. It goes to the Danish government. If the British government of any stripe don't do some of these things, somebody will do it for us and to us, and they will take the benefits out of this country. Why wouldn't we do it for ourselves? So that'll be my argument.
And the Labour are talking about building up to the 28 billion. So, you know, and we would encourage them, both of us, to stick with it. It's the best opportunity we'll ever get to reindustrialise the Northwest and the North more generally in the 21st century. And Steve and I commissioned work to say that we could produce double the amount of energy in the Northwest that we need. So we could be a net exporter. So as Steve said, why wouldn't you take that opportunity? That is when you will start to change the way the country works, with a sort of more balanced approach to industry and jobs and the quality of jobs across the country. Head North gives anyone who reads it direct evidence that the people of Liverpool were treated as second-class citizens in the 1980s, and the people of Greater Manchester were treated as second-class citizens in the pandemic over Tier 3, and then again over HS2. There is direct evidence of that. And are we going to carry on accepting that, or are we going to change things? And that's why, in the end, we call it a rallying call for a more equal country, a rallying cry for a more equal Britain. You know, how much longer are we all going to put up with this? How much longer will we accept a British government in Westminster and Whitehall dividing and ruling this country, as they tried to do to Liverpool and Manchester in the pandemic? You know, the question is, I think, not much longer, because I think people's patience is running out with politics, as it has been in our lifetimes. And I just think, you know, we're ready now. The country's ready, actually, for the substantial change that we're both proposing.
So the book is called Head North, A Rallying Cry for a More Equal Britain, and it is out on March the 7th from Orion Publishing. Steve Rotherham and Andy Burnham, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for the opportunity. Thanks
That's
for your time.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to the Northern Agenda podcast. And don't forget, you can subscribe to our daily newsletter at thenorthernagenda.co.uk. It's more important than ever for Northern voices to be heard. The Northern Agenda is a laudable production for Reach. It's presented by me, Rob Parsons, and it's produced by Daniel J. McLaughlin. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to The Northern Agenda wherever you listen to your podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Also, check out the other Laudable podcasts. See you next week. Bye-bye.